Good morning, and welcome to The Morning Show with co-hosts Phil Huff and Julie Calamine. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, Phil.
And this morning, we're quite excited. We have with us Jack Nisbet, naturalist and author. We are pre-recording this show, so it's over the phone, but otherwise, you'll be hearing it live.
That's correct.
We're quite excited. Jack is one of my favorites, one of Sandpoint's favorites, always a surefire hit, and he will be making a presentation to the Kinnickinnick Native Plant Society meeting January 27th at 9:45 at the Sandpoint Community Hall. That's free and open to everyone.
That's correct. And for those of you who haven't heard of Jack Nisbet, there might be one or two left in Sandpoint. He's an author who lives in Spokane. He is a naturalist, and he's also a museum curator.
So, Jack, tell us a little bit about your background.
I grew up in the Carolinas. My dad's people had a farm on the South Carolina side of the border between Columbia and Charlotte on the Catawba River. And my dad got mad at him and moved across the North Carolina side. So I spent my youth going back and forth. I did natural history as a kid. I had a grandmother who did birds by call and a mother who was from Indiana who was a pinner of insects and general fan of all that kind of stuff. And I guess I came west to escape all that, even though I like it. And I came to Northeast Washington in 1970, 71. I actually went out west to college in California. It was very claustrophobic there. There were too many people there. And I sort of drifted up here with a guy whose dad was an old gypo miner. And he had some claims in Northeast Washington and North Idaho, and we sort of toured around them and ended up building a cabin and starting a house business in Northeast Washington in Stevens County.
So your interest in the natural world seems very family-oriented and from your youth. How did you come to find yourself interested in teaching and writing about it?
When I was working in the construction business in Northeast Washington, just by chance, started a weekly column in a newspaper there that was just a what bird is that, what flower is that kind of column that I wrote all through the 70s. And two things came out of it. One is it was a great apprenticeship for just learning the craft and realizing that I wanted to do more. But better yet, some old ladies and teachers would read the column, and one of them invited me to come. First, I took some Girl Scouts out, and then I took a sixth grade class out, and all we did was go walking out to the sewage ponds to look at shorebirds, which is what I'd been doing. And that made me realize I wanted to do more of those things as well.
Hmm. Well, tell me how your career progressed. What did you start as? Teacher, naturalist, author?
No, I started hanging sheetrock and doing tile work and stonework and brickwork. And then this was a real, it seemed like a natural progression now. It was pretty painful at the time. As I was in Chewila, I met a woman in Missoula. In those days, the Flowery Trail was this terrible dirt road that came down at Newport, and you could take the road over Sandpoint, over the top of the lake to Dixon and the Flathead Reservation. And I met her many times on the Flathead River. We would paddle the Flathead River and go walk in Glacier and all the places. And by then, I'd written my column long enough to understand that David Thompson had done all that previously and had the first animal records and a lot of the first plant records and the first tribal contacts. So I went crazy about that and wrote it up in my columns, but also in a lot of different ways. And after trying to get a book out of it and didn't have the skills to do it really for a long time. I mean, a really long time, 25 years or so. But after 25 years or so, I had a book come out about David Thompson.
Well,
and that was my ticket to just keep doing it, just keep driving that road and following all those trails and getting to do with what I'm still doing. I'm very lucky in that.
Your curiosity of David Thompson certainly leads to the style of approach you took with the book and the research done. And to me, the greatest takeaway of that book is that you seem to go through your own process of discovery mimicking David's. And it would take a naturalist to really appreciate what he was finding.
I never really understood him as a person very well, because he's there's different theories about that, I guess, but I never really got a take on what kind of guy he was in a lot of ways. But in the natural history way, yes, I felt a real affinity for him. And when he would have an afternoon and go out and look at pine grosbeaks, I'd go, man, that's perfect. I understand what he's doing. So that kept me going. And when I discovered that he had 100 journals, notebooks, that had not, many of which had not been transcribed back in eastern Canada, in Toronto, I could go back there and just, like, look for the birds in them. That's how I started. I went through all the journals and got the birds out. Then I went back to them and got the mammals out. And then I went back to them and got the trees out. I mean, it was a very dumb way to do it, but it allowed me to just, oh, well, let's go walk over House Pass again. Let's go canoe the Ponderay again. Let's go do all these things. And it developed the method that I use, which is you just go to a place the same week of the year that somebody earlier went and see what it's like. And then go back again every year for a few years and see how it changes.
Hmm. And I'll bet it really has changed since the days of the gentleman you've written about.
Well, that's the interesting part, is there's places inside the Spokane city limits that have not changed all that much. There's places on the west slope of the Rockies that were great wilderness when he was there that are clear cuts now. So you can never, and the lesson is you can never predict how things are going to play out. I love the randomness of that, and that there's heartbreaking places involved in David Thompson's journeys, but there's a lot of really uplifting things. And if you have a Pollyanna turn of mind, like apparently I do, you can focus on the good things instead of the horrible things.
As you were traveling in his footsteps and trying to explore the world as he saw it, were there any aha moments, something suddenly clicked for you about the natural world as well as David?
Many, yeah. Yeah, you could say he taught me a lot about the Northwest or about the Intermountain West, however you want to define the country. But the real aha moment was after the book came out, or during the latter stages of the book, when I went out with some, for instance, I went out with some tribal people on the stretch of the Columbia River that flows through Hanford Nuclear Reservation. And I was, by then I was pretty conversant in Thompson, and I'd floated this stretch of river before, and I thought I knew what I was talking about. And, I knew that this bird would be here, and here was some history of the nuclear reservation. I knew that stuff. And we got off the river, and this elder, James Salam, said, we should all say something after our trip today. And so I said some pretty stupid things, looking back at it. And it came James's turn, and he said, I really want you to think about what David Thompson missed. That's what I want you to think about. That is what you should be doing. And I've had many people tell me that since, is I'm not doing a really good job at what I think I'm doing, but now that I'm started, once you get on this road and are started, your responsibility is to do a better job and to stick with it. You don't get to quit.
So what are some of the things that David missed?
Everything. he missed it less than a lot of people miss it, but yeah. There's this tribal world that could flow back and forth across the landscape with women and kids and feed themselves and clothe themselves and stay warm and do it at any season of the year in places that were difficult for him. And he was in the business for 25 years. And then came over and spent his six or whatever years on the west side of the Rockies. And he got good at it, but he would still see an 80-year-old man at Cusick. And then the 80-year-old man would explain to him where he was going to winter at the mouth of the St. Regis River, say. And Thompson would paddle as hard as he could to get back there, and the guy would be there with his extended family waiting for him.
And so I do think this brings up a really important connection in your work, both your written work and your historical work and presentations, which is the native culture, the heritage that's there. And it's easy for readers to pick up the book about David because they believe he was the first man to explore, the first white man to explore the world, but the world was there. And you write a lot about
that. That's a great way to say it. The world was there. He had all these blinders on as far as how he would perceive it, and so did anybody else coming from the British Empire or Eastern America, U.S. And he, because he had a tribal wife, because he'd been in the, you know, out in the world for 25 years, he saw less. He had a better perception of it than a lot of the other explorers who may or may not be more famous than him. So that was something that really drew me to him, yes. And as I've gone on, he reads well today. I didn't really understand that when I got into him. It's only as time went on, and I stuck with it and met a couple of the families, both a Kootenai family and a Kalispell family, who had guided him and had their own stories about it. That's when I realized the depth that I was in and how, as you go along, he shrinks. He shrinks. He's a great guy, and he's a wonderful, talented man, but he shrinks in the scope of the story, and the landscape starts to loom very large. And what I realize is the same thing I realized as a kid in the Carolinas, is I just am in love with the landscape. I'm just absorbed by it, and he is a window to get into that.
You've brought up something I think that's very fascinating about David Thompson's story. We think of Lewis and Clark's journey at 2 years being a long one, but David stayed in country for decades. For the listeners who aren't that familiar with his biography, tell us a little bit more about that.
So he was born, he's Welsh, which is, again, a outsider immigrant family. He came to London, his dad came to London and then died immediately, which is the way a lot of great children's literature starts. You get rid of the parents so that the story can begin. And then his mother just disappears. They're in a very tough part of London in Westminster, which is a real ragged part of town at that time. And he has no prospects whatever. But for reasons that I haven't really ever figured out but are there to research for somebody, he gets nominated to go to this charity school that where there was a series of them around London. They're pretty well known. The name of his sponsor is even known. But he goes there, and he ends up in one at Westminster that kind of specializes in carpentry work, so he gets really good at carpentry work. He's being trained to go to the British Navy, and he practices his knots and his woodwork and sewing and those kinds of practical skills. There's girls at the school, which plays very large in his career. And then as he gets out, the American Revolution ends, and there's no jobs in the Navy because they're going to downsize the Navy. So he goes with the Hudson's Bay Company to Hudson's Bay at age 14 in 1784. And he gets here to Sandpoint in 1809. So that's the arc of his career, is just how do I get to Sandpoint? And it takes him a long time to do it.
Oh, like so many people.
Yeah, there's plenty of people that took 25 years to get to Sandpoint. You're right, Phil.
But for all his trips back and forth over the spine of the Continental Divide, he never really left the wildlands of the Northwest, except for the remote out trading posts.
This is another thing that's really interesting about Thompson. When he went back to Montreal, he was 42. He lived to be 87, so his life was not half over. And he lived in the city the rest of his life, although he continued to work and do surveys and go to some amazing places. He was very comfortable in the city. He was the kind of guy who could adapt to where he was. And we could say all his guys stayed here. I mean, all the people who worked for him are all these mixed-blood families that you can see from either town or the reservation all over the Northwest. But Thompson himself was a different kind of animal. He really was.
I think Finney McDonald's still running a clothing store here in town.
Yeah, he is. That's right. That's
right. He was a wonderful map maker, too, and we need to get on to the presentation, and we want to talk a little about the other David, but tell us about David Thompson's keen map-making eye.
When he was about 19, he broke his leg and had to sit around for 9 months because he couldn't walk, and that by chance, he wintered at a fur trade post where the only real trained cartographer in Canada at that time was also wintering. And at the charity hospital where he went to school in London, he'd gotten some really advanced math training up to trigonometry, from British Army officers who worked at Greenwich. So he was really set up for this cartographer. He had the background to really flourish with the rules. So he has a fairly individual sense of how to make maps, but boy, he gets really good at it. And something like running a sextant is a craft that you learn by practice. So Meriwether Lewis, and especially William Clark was a terrific natural map maker, and he had a couple years of working on with a sextant, and he made a great map of their journey. Thompson had 25 years of working with the sextant and before he got here, and he made some really accurate maps that stretch from Hudson's Bay to the Pacific.
Yeah, I've heard that Lewis and Clark even had one of his maps for part of the area they traveled through.
In 1797, Thompson got the first accurate longitude of the Mandan villages on the Missouri and made his first really terrific map. And Thomas Jefferson, who knew everything and had contacts everywhere, managed to get a copy of it, or the original. Apparently it's the original. It's in our Library of Congress. And he made sure that there's a handwritten note on it saying this map belongs to Mr. Lewis, where he sends Lewis and Clark up the Missouri with a library of maps so they can find their way.
That's really amazing. I want to make sure we turn a little bit to David Douglas, whose your account of David Douglas is a fabulous book and greatly influenced my interest in both the natural history of the area, the collector, the plants he collected, but also the gentleman was extremely fascinating.
He is a natural follow-up to Thompson, for me anyway, because Thompson left here in 1812, but all of his men stayed, and when Douglas comes in 1825 to the Columbia District, that's who's guiding him around. This is Thompson's crew plus their children, all by tribal wives. So all of a sudden, you have all these different languages involved. You have the whole sweep of the Columbia River because they go downstream to Fort Vancouver to spend the winter. That's where he meets a lot of them. And so these characters that I knew quite well from working on Thompson, like Jocko Finley or Finnan McDonald, and there's a lot of other ones, those are Douglas's guys. And he has many adventures with them. And the fact that he's into the deep natural history, that he's the first person to come into our world and systematically collect flora and fauna, that was in my wheelhouse there. I didn't actually know about plants very much. I was more of a bird guy. But I learned a lot about plants over the years I was fooling around with Douglas.
And at the time, this was more than just mere academic interest. This was big money.
The most important science in the 19th century and before was plants, because that was medicine and that was money. And the British Empire was minting money and conquering the world basically by the economic angle of taking plants like tobacco or chocolate or breadfruit, moving them to a different hemisphere, and growing them commercially. So it was... there's a real negative aspect to it, if you want to think about colonialism, but it was, you just can't overestimate how important it was.
Yes, it sounds like it was very important at the time. And how did researching and understanding what the gentlemen of that time were doing influence you in your research? It sounds like you have had some very personal and active research.
My wife and I work together, and she is really good at being in the archives and ferreting things out and transcribing handwriting, which is what a lot of it is. I mean, our goal is always to take original manuscripts and do something with them. That's our method. So we travel. We did a certain amount of traveling, but in these days you can get a lot of it through interlibrary loan or on the web, and just... again, make sure that it has this local connection, and then try to put down what the person said in their day book the day that they said it, and then go to that place and see what is still there that they collected. And Nick Douglas just worked perfectly for that.
And no one had really written about these guys much before you, had they?
Oh, no. No, that's not true.
No?
There'd been a bunch of books about Thompson, all Canadian and mostly for children, which mystifies me. There's still a lot of kids' books about Thompson in Canada. there'd been several books about him, and there'd been four sort of biographies of Douglas, some of which were amazing. But I didn't ever think I would write about either of them. I really didn't. But the more I learned, the more I realized that Thompson, the people who wrote about Thompson tended to be English professors because he wrote a beautiful line. And they were working off in his autobiography that he wrote when he was 70 and 80 years old. So they missed a lot of these on-site journals, which are just chicken scratch and numbers, you know, in a day book. The people who had written about David Douglas were gardeners, horticulturalists, and they were just interested in, their main focus was in his garden plants. What I had through Thompson and through living in the, you know, living around this necklace of reservations that include the Kalispell, Spokane, Colville, Flathead, Kootenai, Nez Perce, Coeur d'Alene, is I had a tribal point of view. I had an oral thread that I had gradually learned by listening to elders and often teaching their kids and grandkids and going out with them. And so I had this oral thread to compare, and I had this landscape to compare with the written thread. So I had different ways to approach it. And that just seemed to fit, and it made a very different story than the ones that were in the books that were already published.
You know, you're bringing the element of adventure and the natural world and the cultural heritage of this area to your books that authors outside the area might have a really hard time, if not impossible time, of doing.
Well, I'm a big believer in local knowledge, if that's what you mean. So another thing that my wife and I did was systematically try to get all the artwork that was done of our area before photographs, because we believe in art. And we like photographs, but there were some really interesting artists who came. Of course, they had to travel the paths that David Thompson pioneered and that Douglas had traveled on. And so there's a lot of 1850s, 40s, 50s, and 60s paintings. Not a lot. A finite amount of paintings that show the places as they were. And that got very exciting. And that kind of led to doing museum exhibits and visual and object shows of it.
What are some of the surprising things? What did you find out writing about David Thompson that surprised you?
Gee, everything, I guess. Surprise is delight, right? I'm delighted that he could notice that he saw caribou tracks and gravel bars on the Columbia, you know, right at above Kettle Falls. That kind of thing just drives me crazy for... For somebody who's interested in the range of animals or the blooming times of plants, there's just everything about what they have in their journals. It either fits with the world that you know or is outside of the world you know and doesn't seem possible. So, yeah, it's like a constant wheel of, oh, no, I can't believe it, or, oh, yes, that fits. And that makes it, even if it fits, it's just as delightful. That's a surprise, too.
Anything particular about David Douglas stand out for you?
Yeah, the main thing about David Douglas is that he was invited to go from Fort Colville to the Flathead Country by John Work in 1826. And, you know, John Work is going, oh, man, you got to come see this Ponderay Country and the Clark Fork and all that. It'll be great. And Douglas did not go because he got worried. He got worried that the plants he collected were going to rot, and he heard a ship was leaving from Fort Vancouver, and he thought he better get down there and get some boxes of specimens on it. All these reasons not to go, and it's a great lesson. You know, he could have been in Sandpoint and gotten the first real collections and really illuminated what we know about Scotchman's Peak, for instance. He could have illuminated the fauna of the Clark Fork for us. And he didn't go, and I've been mad at him ever since, I guess.
Well, he can't go everywhere.
You can't go everywhere, that's true.
What are some
but
of
he
the...
could have gone here. He could have come. He could have come to the Flathead Country.
What are some of the projects you're working on right now?
Right now, I'm desperately trying to finish a book that's very close to being done that is going to come out this fall that's about a couple who lived on Lake Ponderay in the 1880s and 90s. And were just amazing people. And so a lot of people around Sandpoint and the lake have heard of them. But my bet is that everybody wants to hear about them.
Are you willing to divulge who they are?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure I am. No, I'm building on the work of several other people who have fooled with them. It's John Lieberg and Carrie Lieberg. He was a Gipo miner and prospector, so I like that part about him. And he had a lot of claims on the little North Fork of the Coeur d'Alene, which comes right off the shoulder of Bernard Peak at the south end of the lake. And if you go over Chilco Saddle, which a lot of listeners probably have gone over, that's the little North Fork that you go down into.
And
he had a lot of mining claims there in the 1880s. But he was a plant guy and especially liked mosses. And through the encouragement of another remarkable woman, Elizabeth Britton from New York Botanical Society, she kind of schooled him and helped him send her what became the first published papers about North Idaho mosses, which, again, is pretty out there. That was surprising. And then he was really good at that, and he liked plants. He's a Swedish immigrant. So I don't know how all this works, but he got a job as a field surveyor for the United States Department of Agriculture and started doing these amazing plant surveys. And then this was at the time when the Forest Service was starting to develop, and he did the forest surveys for all the forests north of the Salmon River, all the way to the border, but also ones in Montana, Oregon, California, and Arizona. He was a dynamo. And he has hundreds and hundreds of letters during his government service to go back to D.C. and read these handwritten letters that nobody's ever transcribed.
That sounds fascinating. He's living in the right place for mosses.
I should say.
That's what he says over and over again. This is the place for mosses. He loved to underline words in his letters. This is the place for mosses.
Say,
especially Green Monarch Ridge, yep.
Folks, maybe everyone knows this but me, but what is a gypo miner?
Just a private solo person, the one with the mule, and a prospector that's just out there by themselves, often hoping to get some claims and sell them to a larger company. I mean, mining in the 1880s and 90s, he was here for the Silver Valley boom and the Pritchard boom and all that. He worked for the railroad, so he came through during the first gold rush in 1883 at Pritchard. But he was just a individual prospector, working for anybody.
Well, Jack, in all of your work, you've covered a lot of different things in the natural world, and amongst the plants are edible plants. And I think some of the ways that you weave in the historical or natural uses of them that historically the cultures here have used make the books relevant even today to us. And that's going to, I'd like you to touch on that a little bit, and then we're going to let that lead into the conversation about your upcoming presentation.
If you spend time with the tribes, as David Thompson and David Douglas did, and Lieberg did, and I have to a certain extent because I spent a lot of time teaching in the different schools on the reservations, you realize how important food is and food plants are to all these people. I mean, Thompson is starving to death, and he goes to tribes begging for meat. He wants red meat, and his guys especially want red meat, and they give him these baskets of roots and baskets of dried berries, and he doesn't know what to make of them. he can't stand some of them, and he likes other ones. He understands the taste. It's David Douglas that takes the time to try to figure out what species they are and watch the women cook them up and scratch at them and smell them and describe the taste to some of them. So that's one reason I really like Douglas a lot.
Was Douglas not quite as hungry? He had some time to fix things.
You know, he was a lot of the time, but he just learned. He just always had tribal kids around who would take him home for supper. That's the key. and again, a lot of it is language-based. When he was on the coast, he could speak Chinook jargon, and he got really good at it, and that helped. But when he was our part of the world, Chinook jargon wasn't here yet, so he was at a language deficit, but he always was given he wasn't important to the fur trade guys, so they gave him a 12-year-old to guide him around, and the 12-year-old was often the son of a fur trader and a tribal woman, so they would speak English, French, and Kalispell or Kootenai, say, from the get-go. But they might have picked up some other languages along the way. So he, in his journals, writes down these words where he's trying to sort of hear what the sounds are for some really interesting plants. And some of them are no longer commonly gathered by tribal people. So that is a big deal. That is a big deal. If I'm out with some Spokane elders who know that their grannies pick 17 different kinds of roots and their list is down to 9, and Douglas mentioned one of them, or he mentioned when it was picked or how it was prepared or how it was preserved, that is a huge data point for them.
Hmm.
And so that becomes the game, is what are these plants? And the tribal phrase is, how do you take care of them? We've forgotten how to take care of them. I mean, we know we used to eat these, but we've forgotten how to take care of them, meaning when and how do you preserve them and what's the best way to cook them. Douglas sometimes has tiny phrases that offer clues to that end.
So interesting that what they gave to him, he's now giving back to them.
I like to think of it that way, but believe me, it is very small little bits of information. I'm getting a lot more from them. But it does make them perk up. I mean, they could care less about David Thompson. They're not interested in fur trade, believe me. But plants, they're interested in. And so the way I think about it is David Thompson or Lewis and Clark or anybody that we studied in history is dealing with the masculine side of the world, and they come to a village and they meet the head man, and it's like nation-to-nation politics. David Douglas just is out fooling around with the kids and heading back to the kitchen for supper and saying, well, what is in this root of this earth oven that you're baking here that smells so weird? That's feminine knowledge, and that's fun. Again, it reads well today because we understand, more and more people understand that that's the deep knowledge that keeps us going.
Yeah, so the collector was the gatherer and the hunter-gatherer, David Douglas.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the program you're going to be presenting on here on the 27th.
So when Douglas came into, east of the Cascades, and he did it in very early spring with an express canoe of the Hudson's Bay Company, and there are all these plants blooming that are shrub-step plants that are mysterious. He has a very difficult time telling them apart, but he does see tribal people eating them in different ways. Some of them, they eat the shoots of some just when they come up green out of the ground. They dig the bulbs of other ones. They cook them in different ways. It's very confusing to him. And these plants, there's one group called biscuit roots. The Latin genus is Lomatiums, that are especially hard to tell apart. And I have been befuddled by them for years, but I do really enjoy them because the tribal ladies I go out with, especially Spokane and Wanapum and Nez Perce, they dig different kinds of biscuit roots in there by volume, a huge part of their diet. And they smell differently, they taste differently, and they're just really neat plants.
Hmm. Well, so was there a reason that they needed to know them so carefully? Was anything potentially dangerous?
All that. There's a whole element of nutrition involved in which ones you combine with what foods to make a complete nutritional meal. They are in the parsley family, which there's several poisonous members of the parsley family, like water hemlock,
right,
that are really poisonous. And Lewis and Clark went through the same arc. And they're getting ready to go back across the mountains in 1806, and they're at a Flathead Nez Perce village. And they say, "Well, we'd like to send all our guys out to gather some more of these plants, but you know what? A lot of them are poisonous, and we're really worried. So we're just going to keep trading for them with the Indians. But when you just trade for roots, you don't know exactly what you're getting. You're trusting that the women know what they're doing." The phrase in fur trade journal after fur trade journal is the people have all gone to the plains to gather roots, or the women have all gone to the plains to gather roots, or Lewis and Clark want to trade for some horses to go back across the mountains. The women have taken the horses to the plains to gather roots, and they don't have any to trade. It's just all consuming. It's great. It's really great.
And once they get the roots, they have to figure out literally what to do with them.
There is huge, for the tribal people, there's a huge amount of work in processing them. And that's why, I mean, think about it. Everybody, every farmer in our world has a mortar and pestle on their living room table, you know, on, that they found when they were plowing the ground. Those were all pounding roots. They were used to pound the roots. And they mix different kinds together. They add fat and berries and meat. And, you know, they make these little cakes. It's individual families do it differently. It's all about recipes and cooking. There's nothing written in stone about it. When I say something, when Douglas has a little piece of information, he's talking about how one family does it. And everybody has different tastes, and that you do, the tastes that you like are the ones you eat as kids. So there's just a whole cultural universe wrapped up in these plants. Hmm. And that's why I like them. And they just go on and on. When John Lieberg first gets into plants, he sends some of these mosses back, and the people back east realize he's got something going on, and a professor from Minnesota comes, and Lieberg takes him up into the mountains above Lake Bonderay, and they collect what is now called Sandberg's biscuit root, which is abundant in places like Upper Scotchman's Peak after you get above Timberline. And that makes it very evocative just to walk up Scotchman's Peak to me and see Sandberg's biscuit roots. And the fact that grizzly bears in the spring paw at them in Glacier Park, that makes it really evocative. Then you can start thinking, wow, there's some real deep time connections here that I don't even know if I can understand. But I can nibble on one if you go up Scotchman's Peak as the snow is receding and say, huh.
It doesn't matter how good they are. I'm not fighting a grizzly over it.
Luckily, there are zillions of them. That's another aspect of most of these lomatiums, is they are so abundant. There's places all over the West you can go, all over the Columbia Plateau, I should say, but mostly the Columbia Plateau, that the ground just looks completely golden or completely white. They tend to be yellow or white. Hmm. And that it is untold numbers of these plants. So you don't feel like you're hurting anybody by digging a few.
Yeah, there's a couple favorite peaks in the area I won't name that are off trail where there's quite a few of them.
Yeah, right. You can get the times where you just say, wow, there's some, and there's some, and there's some, and there's some, and everywhere I turn.
So are they still important to the tribes today?
The answer to that is most certainly yes. The word coos, C-O-U-S, or cows, depending on how you want to pronounce it, any of the Sahaptan-speaking tribes, the ones down in the southern plateau, Wanapum, Walla Walla, Yakima, Nez Perce, Warm Springs, Umatilla, They all really focus on coos, but there's cows. There's other the tribes up in our area are more about Canby's biscuit root. Yes, they're really important. They're really important. The Spokane tribe, for instance, has a day every spring where they go out on BLM land with the entire school and whatever adults want to come, which usually amounts to 500, 600 people, and they dig all day.
Wow. So you may have answered the question already by talking about how abundant they are, but is there any evidence that they were ever cultivated or domesticated, or are they strictly a gathered food?
This is another Western civilization, tribal civilization question, I guess. Most of these plants are very hard to transplant. Most of the lomatium, the lomatiums are. Many of them are in Europe are cultivated plants, like parsley and carrots and caraway. And I mean, if you've grown a garden and seen those little umbrellas that carrots put up for their blooms, that's anything that's in that family is the parsley family. So the answer is, as soon as missionaries get here, they're trying to get the tribes to plant potatoes, which are not as nutritious, do not taste as good, and are totally satisfying to all these European guys who grew up with them, and that's their comfort food. So potatoes replace them as soon as gardens get to be grown, because mm-hmm. potatoes can grow really a lot of volume.
True.
Because they've been cultivated so many times. So I think my answer, but I'm not sure, is that nobody's spent a lot of time cultivating these biscuit roots and tried to make them commercial. But it wouldn't make any sense to me, because it's the it's the shrub steppe and the mountains and the habitat that they live in that make them nutritious. Let me say one more thing about about that question. I think the way to answer that question is to say, so I've heard tribal people say, oh, yeah, this old guy, he was so lazy, he went up and got bitterroot or biscuit root or whatever, and he just tried to plant it by his house, and so he wouldn't have to go up in the hills to gather it. And it did fine the first year, and it was okay the second year, but over time it just got less and less vigorous until they just sort of withered up and went away because that wasn't their plot. That wasn't their place.
Right.
And they spend a lot of time thinking about place.
Yeah.
And that's what we want to think about. That's all we want to think about is place. Do we fit here? Does this belong here?
Wild things often don't do well when they're domesticated.
Exactly. Exactly. True. They belong up on Scotchman's Peak, of course.
Yeah. Well, Jack,
you wouldn't go anywhere else.
You have a huge fan base that I know is looking forward to your presentation on the 27th. We're running a little low on time. Any closing thoughts for us? Anything we haven't touched on you'd like to mention?
No, I'm good, Phil. You ask me another question. There's a million things to mention.
I think Julie's got one more, and then we'll wrap up.
Well, let me just wrap up by saying that John Lieberg was an interesting man. He had a wife who was a physician who was at least as interesting as he was. And it's their partnership that makes me want to write a book about him, not just what he's doing. And I guess at the stage that I'm in, I don't really feel like I need to write another book about a white guy pushing back the wilderness. but the idea that there's a couple on Lake Ponderay that have very different paths that they're pursuing, but are willing to support each other and go through some real troubled times and have a family that has some real problems and work their way through that, that's what I'm interested in right now.
It sure does sound interesting. Such a great interview that we're having, and it's making me very much look forward to the presentation this coming weekend, and I'm just hoping that there will be plenty of pictures of biscuit roots and maybe some paintings that you've talked
about.
There
are plenty of pictures and paintings of biscuit roots, but very few, because they aren't a deemed attractive plant.
Well, beauty is the eye of the beholder.
That's right.
Yes, exactly. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us this morning, Jack. We sure appreciate it.
And My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you also. And just a reminder to everyone that Jack's presentation will be Saturday, the 27th, from 9:45 a.m. until 11:30 a.m. at the Sandpoint Community Hall. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, guys.